Hello and welcome to This Week in Wealth, a brand new podcast from Citywire RAA, in which we recap, discuss and opine on the biggest stories in the world of wealth management from the last 7 days. I'm Alex Steger and I'm joined today by Ian Wenick. Ian, hello.
Good to be on.
And Sam Bojarski. And this, I've worked with Sam now for 2-3 years and have maybe never said his name correctly. Did I get it right that time, Sam?
You got it. Yeah, great to be here.
Good. Well, good to have you both here. Thank you for coming. I hope you're well rested after your holidays and ready and raring to go for 2025. This podcast, though, is not concerned with all of 2025. What we are concerned with is the last 7 days. What have been some of the biggest stories that we at Citywire RAA have covered, and why should readers and indeed listeners care? Ian, you're going to kick us off with what I think we're going to broadly and perhaps grandiosely describe as the rise of sovereign wealth funds in the world of RAAs.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's popped up twice this week, the most recent of which was yesterday. By yesterday, I mean Tuesday. We're taping this on Wednesday, when the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority and Advent International, they closed on their deal to invest a combined $3 billion into Fisher Investments, which manages about $300 billion, one of the largest independent wealth managers in the U.S. And you know, those two investors had previously tipped they'd invest between 2.5 and 3, and they're coming in on the high end of that range. And I think that as these firms scale up, get bigger, get more professionalized, we're going to see more sovereign institutional investment in these spaces, and we can get into why.
Okay, so Fisher, that deal closed, but that's not the only one. So 2024, there were three that we know of, is that right?
Yes, there were a couple. So Mubadala Capital, which is associated with Abu Dhabi, they agreed to take CI Financial private, which is the parent of Corient Private Wealth. And then I had the pleasure of learning from an interview with Mercer Advisor CEO Dave Welling that GIC, which is the Singaporean Sovereign Wealth Fund, they managed to take a stake in Mercer over 2024 and almost nobody noticed.
Nobody noticed. It was there. They did disclose it, just people didn't pick it up, which is rare because regular readers of Citywire will know if there's one thing we do pretty well, it's pick up on deals, even those people don't want us to. Okay, so what does this tell us? We've had three deals that we know of, at least, that have happened. What can we take from that? Are there commonalities between them? I don't know, in terms of the size of the firms they're buying, the maturity of those firms in terms of, you know, where they are in the investment cycle within them.
Well, we talk about how banks are too big to fail. I think that we're getting to the point where some of these wealth managers are too big for any one person to buy. I mean, you think about some of the valuations that these companies have. I mean, I believe that Fisher Investments was valued at about $12.75 billion, which represents an earnings multiple that we broke of between 20 and 21 times its earnings. You know, there are very few private equity firms that can cut an equity check by themselves of that size. There's maybe 3 or 4, maybe 5. And so what you end up having is you see what we call club deals, which is where you see a consortium of private equity investors team up with either other private equity firms or sovereign funds, pension plans to invest in these wealth managers. And when you think about the underlying investment thesis that has made RAA so attractive to PE owners, which is very steady, predictable cash flow, that market length that you can lever up, that it makes perfect sense for sovereigns to come in because they view RAAs as this perpetually cash-generating asset. Why wouldn't you want to hold on something like that that basically gives you a 60-40 portfolio you can lever up twice and hold on to that for 20, 30 years?
Okay, and in terms of the firms they bought, they're all of a pretty chunky size. They're not buying $1-2 billion RAAs. They're sort of in the 10s, sort of 60s, 50s.
Exactly. I mean, Mercer 70, Corient is about 130 something billion, and Fisher's obviously 300 billion.
Crazy numbers. And what does this mean for, I guess, a lot of the existing PE investors in RAAs? I mean, if we think, I don't know, zoom out, say like sort of the last 5 to 10 years, that's been, well, after the sort of first wave, which was big breakaways, which was, I suppose, phase one of the RAA movement, sort of phase two has been this sort of crazy investment from from PE money, initially buying, you know, a few firms, and then more recently, these sort of big PE-backed aggregators smashing lots of firms together. Is this kind of a stage three? Is this good news for those PE firms because it gives them an exit that perhaps was not there before?
I think if you're a PE investor, it's great news. I mean, this is your off-ramp. This is your life raft. I mean, we've written about for years the issue of what does an ultimate exit point for these private equity investors look like? I mean, you can't just ride on the PE carousel forever. Eventually, someone's going to want to monetize or else they're left holding the bag. And I think we've seen in the last couple of years that the public markets have not proven to be particularly hospitable to wealth managers. You look at the multiples that wealth managers or wealth-adjacent businesses have traded at. It's in maybe best case scenario, that 12 to 14 times earnings range, which is a fraction of what we've seen some of the largest and best run RIAs trade at, which is north of 20. So instead of having multiple compression, lighting your investors' money on fire, why not invest in someone who's willing to come in at that multiple and is willing to hold on to it for years or decades?
Oh, because I'm going to end this section with an unfair question, but it's the kind of question that journalists particularly like asking our interviewees at the start of the year, is for a prediction, for gaze into your crystal ball then. So we had three of these big deals that we know of last year. Do you expect there to be more this coming year?
I think that you can definitely see that. I think another thing that could be on the table is we see more mergers of equals. I think at a certain point we talk about the aggregation of the aggregators. I mean, there's only so many $1 to $5 billion firms coming on market. Eventually, we're going to see some of these $10, $20, $30 billion firms look to join together.
And, or even bigger than that.
Or even bigger. Some of the sort of the question is, you know, who's going to be the first mover? I mean, I always tell joke I like to tell is the Joker used to tell us in a famous Batman comic that there's two escaped mental patients who break out of Arkham Asylum, and there's a bridge, like a small plank between the roof to get out. And one of the mental patients says to the other, "I'll go across first, and then I'll shine the flashlight for you." And the mental patient goes, "Are you crazy? You're just going to turn the light off." So who's going to have that level of trust? Who's going to be the first mover?
Okay, what, to sort of to try to merge their
exactly.
With another. And what, and the idea would be that then you think possibly that would be backed by a sovereign.
It's possible, or a mega P, or a couple of mega P firms.
Sam, you very politely raised your hand here.
Well, I mean, I just jump in here and say that I'd expect to see more minority investors coming into the space. I mean, we saw Constellation Wealth launch about a year ago in January of 2024. Rise Growth Partners made their first deal, although they actually launched in 23, I believe. But I'd expect to see more minority investors, especially as some of these founders might be looking out there, seeing a sea of private equity investors and maybe wanting more control over their firm.
Okay, so at the bigger end, you've got these completely new, you know, literally sovereign wealth funds coming in and looking to do something sort of larger in the things, but it doesn't mean the end of smaller PE firms. That's still something that's happening, and that's generally run by kind of people who are experts in the space. I think the two that you mentioned, in the case of Rise, that's maybe Joe Durand's.
Rise is run by Joe Durand, former United Capital executive. Yeah, so these vehicles are run by former RIA executives, investment banking folks.
And they're fishing at a very different end, though, aren't they? So obviously, the sovereigns, as discussed, are going for sort of the huge, maybe $50 billion plus type sort of consolidator operations or firms that have already done a lot of their acquisitions. The examples that you gave of these new, smaller scale acquirers, they're still looking to pick up the sort of single-digit billion-dollar RIAs. I guess my question there, question for both of you, is, are there enough of those? Have they all been bought? Are there still enough of those types of firms coming to market?
No, there's still a fair number. I mean, we continue to see a lot of movement from the wirehouse space into the independent space. There's billion-dollar, billion-plus firms leaving wirehouses, perhaps on a monthly basis, you know, even more frequently.
Got it.
I think the good news, too, is that, you know, with the markets going the way that they had the last couple of years, it doesn't take that long for an $850 million firm to all of a sudden become a billion-dollar plus firm.
Yeah, of course, that's a fair point. Everyone's a lot bigger than they used to be. All right, well, look, we might come back to some of these things towards the end, but I'd like to pivot quickly. And Sam, this is your area of expertise to talk about, or broadly to talk about regulation. Obviously, as keen students of the news cycle will have noticed, there was an election last year, and we'll have a new administration starting this month.
Heard something about that, yeah.
You heard something? You read that too? Okay, yeah, good. Not like that Mercer story that you missed. And obviously, one of the most direct impacts that can have on an RIA's life is what happens to the SEC. Sam, can you shed a little bit of light as to what we think the SEC is going to look like over this year and obviously over the next four?
Yeah, so obviously, I will have a Republican president taking office this month, Donald Trump. He's already nominated a SEC commissioner who's worked under a former Republican administration, that of George W. Bush. Trump nominated Paul Atkins about a month ago to lead the SEC. Atkins is an attorney. He has a legal background, and he's done a lot of scholarly work on enforcement, specifically trying to like tweak some of those enforcement incentives at the SEC, where folks might get rewarded for bringing a high volume of cases, high dollar load.
So yeah, you wrote a really good piece about this towards the end of last year. Listeners, go check it out. We'll put a link in the description. And if I remember that correctly, that he had sort of beef with a couple of things. So yeah, one was that too much enforcement focused on sort of what he didn't really believe were big ticket issues. And it was sort of almost enforcement for its own sake. And these weren't really particularly egregious things that firms had done. He also seemed to have an issue with sort of the idea of rulemaking via enforcement. So not going through the proper steps to actually get a rule, voted on and approved, but instead kind of taking a number of enforcement actions that effectively tell firms what they can and can't do. And I think one big example of this that he had a problem with was what's called off-channel communications, which is basically sort of using WhatsApp instead of your work email. Have I got that right?
Yeah, using WhatsApp when you can't archive it. Advisors have to archive their communications. And if they're not using an archiving service along with text messaging and WhatsApp, then they can get into trouble.
Okay, so he doesn't think that was really worth the SEC's time. Is that a fair summation?
Yeah. He talked, I believe, this past April about scaling back the level of enforcement there on off-channel communications, which the SEC has really been going after since 2021, 2022.
So yeah, broadly in line with what we sort of expect to happen, Republican government, less keen on rules and regulations, smaller government, etc. So we can expect to see less enforcement. What on the rulemaking front? Are there rules that are kind of currently in play that we could see going? Are there any sort of particular priorities for rules that he or this administration might have?
Yeah, so I definitely expect to see less big ticket enforcement actions from the SEC. But on the, on the item of rulemaking, we had one of the most active, perhaps heavy-handed, as some industry groups have said, SEC under Gary Gensler, and a couple pending rules are related to custody and AI or predictive data analytics, and some industry folks that I've talked to have expect to see perhaps a reproposal of custody or AI, one of those rules, or both.
Perfect. Thanks. Okay. Well, let's round things up. The idea of this podcast is to keep things relatively short, give people just the biggest stories and the hottest takes, of course. So I do want to end with a little bit more forecasting. So here we are, first full week back of work of 2025. We've discussed a couple of big things that we expect to see over this year. Any other business? What are you looking out for, Ian? Any other trends that you're keeping an eye on that might shape basically what we end up writing about over the next 12 months?
Yeah, I think another thing to keep an eye on is just, we talk about the professionalization, the institutionalization of this business.
This business being RIA.
The RIA industry specifically. We've seen a lot of turnover in the executive ranks, especially chief executives. A lot of founders have moved on in the last couple of years. I think about Ron Carson kind of stepping aside at his own eponymous company for Burt White. That's a company where Bain Capital has significant influence. We saw Scott Hansen, Pat McClain step aside at Allworth, John Bunch, now running the show there. He used to work at Edelman Financial Engines. You mentioned Edelman. I mean, even Rick Edelman himself has taken an operational step back. And so I think we're at a point now where we're seeing a lot of these businesses that were originally founder personality-driven businesses based on the charisma of a strong leader. They're much more depersonalized, institutionally driven businesses.
And again, not to just talk about PE all the time, but the ultimate driver is that all these firms at some point took some kind of minority or majority investment from PE. And over time, I mean, I guess it's always their plan to sort of step back. That's why you sell your business. So that's one trend. But also those PE firms are perhaps looking to have a greater degree of control over some of those businesses than perhaps they wanted to or felt they needed to initially.
Exactly. I mean, look, once you have another investor in the room, you don't run the show purely anymore. You have other constituents to serve.
And I suppose, Sam, that might feed back into the point you made earlier about there's always going to be new RIAs, because obviously not only have you got those RIAs, as has always been the case, sort of breaking away from the wires and broker-dealers, but also now perhaps as founders and other people step back from RIA businesses, you might have other advisors wanting to leave and hang up their own shingle rather than be a part of a big, slightly more corporate type workplace.
Yeah. Yeah, it depends. I mean, we've seen, you know, it depends on what the goal of, you know, what the ultimate goal of the ownership is. I mean, how influential they are in the investment process. Are they coming in and changing leadership? Things like that, you know.
Interesting. Okay. And Sam, let's end with you then. One more big trend that you're watching for 2025.
Yeah, I'd point to the regulatory trend of cash sweep. I mean, we've seen a couple of the large Wall Street firms, LPL Financial, Wells Fargo, a couple others have disclosed that the SEC is probing their cash sweep programs.
Yeah, they set aside money, didn't they, to kind of cover the potential fallout from this?
Yeah. And at the same time, there's been, you know, a flurry of lawsuits from private individuals on this issue. So, you know, it really remains to be seen. But, you know, if we see a less heavy-handed SEC, perhaps, you know, is that going to put the ball back in the court of private individuals to file more of these lawsuits against wirehouses or possibly RIAs? But
yeah, it was a big story, obviously, a story that has its roots in the fact that rates went really high, but those weren't necessarily passed on to clients. Does seem like an issue. Yeah, really interested to see whether that's something that the SEC continues to kind of take up, or whether, yeah, to your point, it sits with the investors in there, in no way ambulance chasing lawyers to hold those firms accountable. We shall see. So let's recap really quickly. What are we looking out for in 2025 RIA land? Bunch more sovereign deals, probably way less regulation, maybe more founders squeezed out or choosing to step back from their firms, and a change of culture thereof, and keep an eye on what happens with all those cash sweep cases. There you go. The week in wealth, but also I kind of feel, for this episode at least, the year in wealth. Ian, Sam, thank you very much. Listener, thank you very much. And we'll be back next Friday. Goodbye.